And I would ask if our panelists, Sinead Belcher, Ursula Shear, and David Farrar would come up to the table here. This is this coconut shy at this end of the room. Thank you very much. As with this morning's panel, I will leave the panelists to introduce themselves. Just suffice for me to say that Sinead is the group online editor for Fairfax, so this is the right of reply from Fairfax from the front. Ursula Shear is an associate professor of law at the University of Canterbury, and nobody knows who David Farrar is. I don't know how he got in the room. Okay. So I guess you lead off, according to the order here.
Me?
Yes, you.
I thought I would just give basically a brief overview of what it's like to be in my position in the media and the sort of issues we're dealing with in this internet age. I'm the digital editor for Fairfax, which means I'm the editor for Stuff and our other sort of websites, newspaper websites. So I'm immersed 24/7 in internet media, and I'm still really getting my head around what it means for us as journalists. One thing's for certain, it's changing so fast that just when we think we've come to some sort of conclusion about the way to do things, the world has moved on. Seems, you know, just about every day we turn around and trip over some 19-year-old super geek who's made millions out of shaking up the establishment and ruining our traditional media model. You just ask Rupert Murdoch, because those teenage billionaires don't play fair. Just as an example, I think Lance was talking about this before. You know, when we think about the impact of the internet and the sort of on reporting and reporting court proceedings, I think Twitter is really, you know, at the forefront of some of the issues. You know, a year ago we sat down to sort of discuss some of our social media strategy at Fairfax, how we would incorporate or utilise or deal with things like Facebook and Dig in terms of what we did on our internet sites. And we weren't even talking about Twitter then. I don't think anyone even mentioned the word. But now, you know, a year later, and we're even at that point, even 3 or 4 months after that discussion, it has just become such a primary thing about the way that we not only distribute information, but find out what's happening in the news. It has become this amazing tool for information to be distributed instantly. The news media are certainly not in control of that, and we're not even a major player in it. We're kind of a bit player, and we've kind of had to try and jump in the stream to make the most of the opportunities there for us. You know, we have reporters in court on their laptops, filing, rolling story updates from big cases. There's, in all likelihood these days, people sitting in the public gallery with their, you know, iPhones or Blackberries and, you know, tweeting latest developments in court, completely ignorant, unaware or just uncaring of what the sort of conventions are around court reporting about issues like suppression and contempt. How do you control that? It's instantly gone out, and we're not talking 5 minutes, we're talking 5 seconds before it's live on the internet. A judge makes a decision at the end of the day or even half an hour later to suppress some evidence or someone's identity. It really is too late. It's gone. Even if you want to call it back, you can't. And that's something we've learnt on a few occasions too, rather painfully at Stuff when we have tweeted a piece of news that has later turned out to be incorrect. I think in a reasonably innocuous way, we might have given somebody a knighthood he didn't earn. He's got it forever now if you're looking on Twitter. So, yeah. So I think, you know, one of the primary things for us in our role working as internet journalists is, A, we really want to act responsibly, and we do. You know, to us, the principle of open justice is absolutely fundamental, absolutely important. Yes, we push that to the limits, but we never, as far as I can ever remember deliberately breach suppressions or anything like that. We act in what we think is the best interests of the public that we represent. We're the eyes and ears of them at court proceedings. I'm quite interested in this sort of assumption that, yes, we have open justice, but at the same time we have practical obscurity of that open justice, is really the idea that information is not conveniently available. Is that a happy bedfellow with the principle of open justice? It's something I struggle with. I also want to sort of get across the idea that I think there's a real educational need here at Fairfax Digital. I spend a lot of my time trying to educate the rest of our company about what's happening in the internet, what these changes and what these things called Twitter or the Google mean for us. You know, sometimes it's hard to get some of that through to some of the crusty old newspaper editors who think that if we didn't exist, their papers would be selling twice as many copies. But it's a really important function of our job, and I think there is also a kind of potential there for people like me in the media to be involved in that kind of education process and the wider community, particularly our judiciary, our court systems. I found it really interesting listening to Judge Harvey and some of his comments. Some of them were really good, some of them I found slightly alarming. And I thought at the end of that, what I would like most for was to sit down with him and really explain how we operate as a news reporting institution, how our reporters in court operate, you know, how are we supposed to make decisions in terms of suppression when we are writing a rolling report from court, yet someone from TV3 or The Herald is sitting beside us writing the same things, and we're each you know, choosing which elements we can report that won't maybe identify someone whose name's suppressed. The reporter beside ours is choosing different elements, but this is all happening in quite real time. It's not like anyone's had time to look at the end of the day and put all the information together and then decide what they can go ahead with in the next day's paper. It's a really challenging world for us, and, you know, as I say, we're living it every day, 24/7, so I think that really valuable for us to have this discussion, but I think you know, if one thing's become clear to me from today, that there is far more discussion and education needed.
Thank you. Isla.
Thanks very much, Frank. I've got sort of three or four points, and in a way it's a bit hard being at the end of the day because almost everything I was thinking of saying has been said. So I'll try and kind of summarise this in a way that's maybe a bit new and interesting. But I'm very much, my position is very similar to Stephen's. I certainly don't think that the horse has bolted in relation to the internet, and I know that's what you're interested in here today, and I've been very interested to hear what internet practitioners have said, and indeed I'm always interested in what the media say because I don't know enough about either of those worlds to kind of put the legal view together. So I want to thank everybody for that. It's been a very useful seminar today for me in any event. But really kind of trying to take an overview about what I see really through reports in the media and what's happening with suppression, I guess I'd say these things. First of all, I think... this Law Commission report is going to be hugely valuable. A lot of the problems we've talked about today, I think probably about half of them will be solved. If you're going to, I mean, law reform reports, I'm always in favour of them. I used to work for a law commission. But this is like motherhood and apple pie, this stuff. It says, let's clarify the law. Let's let's limit it. Let's worry about freedom of expression first, let's make our priority open justice, and then let's look at suppression from there and make it available in much stricter circumstances and in very clear circumstances. So I don't really see how anybody can kind of argue with that as a starting point. And the worries about suppression orders being breached, in particular on the internet, are going to be reduced because of that. There are going to be less suppression orders, one assumes, if these recommendations are implemented and if they're implemented well. So I think as a starting point, that's great for not only media, but also for ISPs and anyone connected with providing services around the internet. But once you've done that, then you're kind of saying that the suppression orders that are left over are pretty much almost always going to be justified. And you're going to want to preserve the situation so that the law can be enforced. So there is some duty then on the state, and that means Crown Law and the police, to enforce breach of suppression and contempt laws where necessary. And that's where we come to the point of, you know, what are the reasons that are given around this kind of sometimes quite hysterical reporting around suppression, especially lately. So I kind of tried to separate out the strands that come out of this reporting. Often they're kind of, all the reasons are, you know, mushed in together and they're not separated out in any context. So these were the kind of separate threads I see around the worries around suppression, certainly coming through in the media anyway. And the first one, well, most of them have been touched on, but the idea that celebrities get orders too easily, and we've had quite a lot of discussion around that. I think Warren addressed a lot of them, but the Law Commission report will and should address any issues around those if they are real. So in theory then, celebrities aren't going to get suppression orders too easily, and although the nature of their celebrity and how that affects their individual life and any exceptional harm that may occur to them will be taken into account, it won't be the only reason and it won't, we hope, lead to them getting orders automatically, not that they have been in the past in any event. In fact, I've seen a bit of a trend the other way more recently. The second thread or kind of concern around suppression orders I've observed have been this idea that judges give too many suppression orders. Well, first of all, the Law Commission report has got some stats on that, and although they were, you know, they yielded up kind of limited information from allowing for for example, an increase in cases going through the district court. The stats you'll see in here show no evidence of an increase in suppression orders, particularly in the district court. So that's often suggested in reporting around this issue, and there's no real evidence to support that one way or the other. And Stephen Price in his blog also has given some excellent description of what suppression orders are about, why they're given, and you know that I think shows quite strongly that most of them are justified and can't be argued as being, you know, excessive in the excessive category. Another quite strong thread that you see, particularly in the media, is, and it's kind of only hinted at, but it's this idea of, and I know media certainly expressed this to me directly, is the idea that, well, bloggers are getting away with it. We get stung all the time, or we as media are expected to behave and we do our best and we make the odd mistake and we're stung for that sometimes. And it doesn't seem fair that all these bloggers and, you know, what about Facebook during the Clayton Weatherston trial and all that sort of stuff? And I think the answer to that is... And I guess it's the answer, I'm going to make this point later on as well, but it's really the state of the internet now. And I'll mention that in the context of this argument, this further thread that I take out of this reporting, which is that names are all over the internet now, the horse is bolted, it's too late, you can't enforce it, futility and so on. And my answer to that is, well, you know, we're in the gold rush period still. We are. Media are still talking about, well, we're needing to get used to it. Judges are needing to get used to what media are doing, what ISPs are doing, what bloggers are doing, how it all works. And a lot of that just requires, as Sinead said, a sharing of information, more information, people talking to each other, lawyers giving judges information about what they want to do in court, what is twittering about, how it will work in a case with court reporting. A judge decides how their court will operate. They've got the ultimate discretion to say how their courtroom can be used. So they need to know from media, I'm twittering, and that means it gets straight back to the office within 5 seconds and it's online then. And then the judge can make a decision about, well, is this going to happen in this case or do we need to limit it in some way? So I think, you know, because of this, there's still this novelty thing around the internet, I'm hoping and I kind of predict that this isn't new really. We keep talking about the internet as if it's a new challenge. But the law has always faced challenge. And if you look back in history, my other area of interest has been censorship. And you see these challenges to law through technology, you know, starting with the book, I think David Harvey talked about printing and so on. Anytime you have a piece of technology that offers more information to the masses, to the public, you get moral panics around it, and then you get panics around the law as well. And this has been repeated time and time again, the invention of photography, film, video, and now, you know, we're into the digital age. And yes, the internet does mean that stuff goes around quicker and to more people, but the law is always facing challenges of this kind. And that's why I come down to the position that I think eventually things will settle down quite a lot. We won't get this reaction about, well, I can do this on the internet, I'm going to, because I can, sort of thing. And people will lose interest, especially if reporting around it isn't hysterical as well. I think an example of the way the internet is changing and the way people are using the internet is changing is that thousands of editors of Wikipedia are now abandoning writing for Wikipedia. They're just fed up with it, and they're walking away. So there's a novelty part of the internet that's kind of, you know, it's settling down, and maybe it'll disappear completely. How long Twitter will last, I don't know. So whatever our laws are going to be, they're going to have to cope with all of those sorts of things. But I just don't see anything particularly special about the internet that... I've got lots of optimism, really, about the law being able to apply to the internet. And the other side of that is that I think arguments around the inability to regulate blogging, for example, is really incredibly patronising, because it kind of assumes that most bloggers are malicious and vindictive, or indeed thick, and they can't learn the law. I mean, most of us now know that you can't, for example, use your cell phone while you're in your car. Now, that's pretty basic. People are capable of understanding the law when it's explained to them. Now, okay, the laws need to be made clear and reasonably understandable, and that's basically what this sort of thing is aimed at doing. So that would be my response to these arguments about the internet, you know, it's too late and futility and all of that. Connected to that sort of argument, there's only a couple more to go, the argument this is a free speech issue, the internet wants to be free, and that's kind of a bigger, you know, very abstract argument that's useful to media and to internet service providers. But, and we've had that, I think, you know, threads of that coming through in the argument today. Now, I think the first point to make about that is that it's largely inapplicable when applied to suppression. We've already discussed today that we live in a society that doesn't follow the view of America that, you know, free speech trumps all. In England and Australia and New Zealand, we... do the balancing thing. We're more interested culturally, socially, politically, and all of that in a balancing approach to people's rights. And where we accept that harm can result from speech, we do think that laws can quite validly regulate that. So connected with that, this idea about the internet must be free, free speech, you know, trumps all, that in relation to suppression doesn't carry much weight. Because, as already been noted today, where you're suppressing, it's mostly temporary. Permanent suppression orders are quite rare. This report, if followed, I keep hammering that, would mean that they're going to be rarer than ever. So you're really only talking about temporary suppression of speech mostly, and that, as I say, reduces the weight that you give to these abstract arguments about freedom of expression. And I guess the last... thread that I take out of this is the argument that suppression is bad per se. It's kind of connected to free speech. You know, and there's been one or two comments today about there not being such strict suppression in other countries and other jurisdictions. That certainly is true. In England has less name, doesn't rely on name suppression like us, for example. Now, this report doesn't deal with that prior issue. That's a prior issue about, you know, should we have suppression at all. And this is a, because I think this report arose from the evidence project that the Law Commission was looking at, it was much more sort of narrowly focused and worked on a presumption that some sort of suppression is still a good idea. So yes, we could have a larger debate about do we want suppression at all? Do we want completely free reporting as in the US? And there are arguments for and against that, but that's not what this report is about, and I guess our discussion today has kind of worked on the assumption that some sort of suppression is desirable. I think it is. I think fair trial is worth preserving. It's in our Bill of Rights along with free speech. And if we're going to regulate forms of speech temporarily, then I think that's a price worth paying to preserve fair trial, and I think David Harvey has outlined some quite good reasons for that. But I would finish by saying that there's no harm in clarifying, tightening and improving the law around it in the meantime, and that's why I think this is a very good report overall. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And much as I hate to say this, David Farrar gets the final word, at least the final formal word, before we open the floor for discussion. David, it's yours.
Thanks, Frank. I've just got half a dozen slides to accompany what I'm going to talk about. There's really two things. I'm going to talk about the high-profile case specifically, and also more generally about some of the challenges of suppression orders and being a blogger. In terms of the high-profile case, I found it interesting. You know, we heard the Prime Minister had, you know, heard the name, and we heard from Stephen about his class, 30% and 90% knew. On my own blog, I just did a poll saying, do you know the name? Yes, no. Please do not tell me the name, which half a dozen disobeyed anyway, and I had to delete. And what city do you live in to see, is it just people in Wellington and the Beltway who knew? And what I found is 71% of people did know the identity, and that's quite high. Now, this is people, though, who are online quite a bit during the day, so perhaps that's not too surprising. However,
how many of them actually went to, their answer was, I found it, and so I know.
Only one or two. Most already knew. Now, even though that might be 70% of 10% of the population, I still think it goes wider than that, because anyone who's not online but wants to know, ask someone who they think will know. You only need a few thousand people to know for it to become quite accessible to everyone. I'm going to come back to this when I talk about before the internet. If you Google on what I thought would be the best way to find out, I knew already, but I wanted to reverse engineer it, identity of entertainer with name suppression, it does get a front page hit on Google. So if you check the first 10 hits, one of them will tell you who the entertainer is. I went to Trade Me, for that's the biggest site in New Zealand, to see whether I could find it under the forum. And Trade Me do a very good job. Like myself, they get lots of comments they don't see in advance, and they do actually delete them once they become them. But one did slip through under the title, Who's the Dirty Dog Musician with Name Suppression? To which there's half a dozen people provided the answer there. So it's not just, people often think it's all happening on blogs, the breach of name suppression, and it is a bit, but you'll be a bit surprised by some of the other ones. MSNNZ, that used to be the extra homepage, that has the names, because they now allow people to comment on a story. And someone commented on the story and said, the person is so-and-so. And that's still there on MSNNZ's news site. Really funny, Yahoo Answers. This is where you can ask, what's H2O stand for? You know, someone said, what's the name of the musician? And someone has provided the answer, and people vote on what's the best answer. So it's really quite amusing, really. So you've got, you know, quite mainstream sites there. GP Forums, that one, that's the Game Planet people. That, I'd say, is the most regular breach of suppression orders I see on the internet. It's very common to see that come up with name suppression. And one New Zealand blog thought they can sort of not get prosecuted, or they won't be breaching the law by being what they thought is subtle about it. Now, I'll ask anyone still here from Crown Law to close their eyes for just around 2 seconds. This is what they put on their blog, which But personally, I wouldn't like their chances in court if that did find its way there. yes.
Also on Twitter as well.
Yeah, oh, yes, yeah, there's been quite a few cases like that. That wasn't unique there. So, you know, it's not too difficult if you want to find out to actually find out online. Having said that, you're not going to come across it by accident. Is not on the front pages of any sites, etc. Here's what I found really funny. This is the Facebook page of the entertainer in question. I've gone to great lengths to hide all their identities, including, I discovered at the last minute, two of my open tabs mentioned his name for I was searching for it. Oh, is it? What does it say there? Oh, I can't see that. Oh, okay, whoops. Okay, there's one I missed. That's quite embarrassing. But as you can see, on the person's own Facebook page, someone has commented there, hey, you got done on this. So this means his own Facebook page is breaching the name suppression, which he would probably have liability for, because he is the person who controls and can delete comments off there. So that would be an interesting court case, whether you can actually sue the person who the name suppression applies to. And hopefully Crown Law kept their eyes shut during that entire... Well, that was quite accidental, missing the Google search.
Inadvertent.
Very inadvertent. All my boxes went to waste. ZDNet's a major tech site in Australia. They made the case which even if you didn't know how to find the name on Google, that just people, I know a few people who did this, based on the newspaper coverage, the date, it was an Auckland-based thing, you just really had to look up who was playing that week in Wellington, and it was there. So that's not really the internet, that's just people being able to put two and two together. Helpfully, ZDNet also, if you fill those X's in, pretty much gave the game away to in their article. They're based in Australia, so that might be one of the cases where if the Solicitor General gets the agreement with other countries, they could have some issues to deal with too. Going on to more general challenges for a blog owner. First one's finding out what is suppressed. And I've fallen foul of this. I've probably three or four times broken suppression orders, always by accident. One example, John Dewar. It got reported that he'd been arrested and charged, but all of the but details had been suppressed. And I just linked to that story, which was on the Herald, and said, no idea what this is about. I said, of course, you know, Dew is well known to be the person who investigated the Louise Nicholas case. Immediately, or within 10 minutes, the media are very helpful, I have to say. I had around 10 emails saying that is the precise details that the court said were suppressed. And I was, oh, okay, and changed that. But I then said, well, how do I know what is and is not suppressed? To obey a suppression order, don't you need to know what's in it? So I said, can you give me a copy? And the media people said, we'd love to, but we don't get copies. And I'm like, how do you find out? Oh, we sort of just hear on the gossip chain usually from other media. Can't you get it from the court? Well, we ask, but the registrar sometimes won't give it to us because they say the suppression order is itself suppressed. So I think the Law Commission recommendation for a national register of suppression orders is excellent. I think there will be an issue about who gets access to that. If there's information in there that in itself could lead to identities of people, you might want to restrict that to media, but then you've got the issue of do big blogs like myself, will we qualify to be able to know there? I think they talk about you sort of apply if you think you have a need to know, and I think that's not a bad way to do it. There's another interesting one. Have they named the correct person? If an entertainer's name is suppressed and people start saying, oh, I think it might be so-and-so, if they get it wrong, it's not actually a breach. It might be defamatory, but it's not a breach. So, again, you have to actually know if it's correct to be able to enforce the law. None.
I could say that when I did the same searches that David did, and the first hit I got was GP Forums, and I noticed several threads that went off on a completely wrong tangent with the wrong people. My own mother rang me up to find out if what she heard about John Rawls was true. I was able to reassure her. And she could tell her senior citizens art class. But there were a lot of people who seemed to have picked up on some particular wrong, you know, two or three wrong identities and kind of followed off on that, and other people were spreading that name around further.
Yeah. Lucky old John Rawls. I did a search as well. Now, you lot, internet savvy, and I am not, and I found nothing. I found it through reverse engineering. Of course, through my media contacts, I knew the name, so I put the name in. Now, you went to the Facebook site with the name. You knew the guy.
Oh, Facebook was knowing the name.
Exactly. But, yes. So this is interesting evidence, but it's anecdotal. It has no weight at all, really.
Yeah. Quite a few people, when I asked online, though, did say, yeah, it took 3 or 4 minutes with Google. It's a matter of just having a bit of patience. You try different words and phrasing, etc., and usually it will come up. It's also knowing you don't just go to Google. Often it will be on Usenet, which is the old Anarchy, and they're totally unable to be filtered because they instantly replicated to 20,000 servers around the world. So through Google Groups, you can search there too. So, yeah, those who are a bit more internet savvy will be able to find it perhaps beyond the average person. Just going back to the points there, I don't see all the comments made on my site, so often there will be comments that breach it, and it's not until someone points them out that you can take action. And even if you delete the comment, it will still be in Google cache for some days, so that's an issue as a blog owner. Older posts or comments, take the Louis Nicholas detective, whose name I just mentioned before. Yes. Do I have a duty as a blog owner that when he gets suppressed to go through and delete my old posts about him because they're still sitting there for anyone who also sees the Herald story to Google up themselves? The media probably have the same inquiry, and I think that's quite... we heard a bit about that from the Solicitor General earlier, but I would be seeking guidance on that. Then we also get that because often there are other sites that do reveal the name of it, I have to ask myself, am I breaching it by allowing even discussion of this? I first say, what do I do if someone links to a page where it's suppressed? Personally, I think that would pop me in the gun. I will delete a direct link to a page that has a breach of a suppression order. But is a hint a breach? You saw one of the hints before. That was a fairly unsubtle one, but there's some that get remarkably subtle. Bigger question, is a reference a breach? Because what if someone just says, if people want to know, they can find out on the Gotcha blog. I'm not actually going to delete someone just saying what is a fact that another site, as long as they don't give a hyperlink to it, has breached it. Because you often get in the mainstream media, there might be a report that the Daily Telegraph in Britain has revealed the name of the All Black. And people then go to telegraph.co.uk and find out. So personally, I might be wrong. I sort of say, link no, hint, only if it's incredibly subtle, references won't take action on. Something that might surprise people, though, I get frustrated when there are some blogs out there that flagrantly breach suppression orders. Take the Clint Rickards trial. There was one feminist blog, well-intentioned, who was outraged about, not revealing the others had rape convictions. And they actually, revealed this, and a few of us pleaded with them, look, you might jeopardise the trial, but they refused to take it down, and nothing actually happened to them. And it doesn't provide the best incentive for those who do spend quite a bit of their unpaid time trying to comply with the law when nothing does happen to those who do quite deliberately break it. Now, I think it's good the Solicitor General says he only probably prosecutes, 2 or 3 a year out of the 30 or 40. But when it's totally deliberate, I think, there might need to be, perhaps agreeing with Ursula, an example made at some stage on that. Finally, just some thoughts. Suppression orders work well, I think, for low-profile disputes where no one really cares. But they're ineffective when a public figure's involved. It's not just this latest one, there's been many of them. And the irony is, the higher profile they are, the more likely they might be to be able to make the case for suppression, and the more likely it is that it will get ignored. Now, I think, again, the Law Commission reports a good step in the right direction there, that the so-called celebrity factor will be reduced. But even if it's not, I don't think there's any celebrity who gets away with it now because it does come out. But that doesn't affect all the other cases where name suppression does work. it relies on a collective amnesia. We sort of heard from Stephen, you know, you're allowed to say things a year before the trial, but not a week before the trial. And, of course, the problem is the internet, though, doesn't suffer from the same amnesia that our human minds do. Something quite important is that this isn't just an internet problem. The internet has made it quicker to find out who got name suppression, and they've probably made it a bit more transparent. But I use the example of the Wellington taxi chick case, which I think was early 1990s, certainly well before the internet. And I'd say everyone in Wellington got to find out who was the high-profile person who got name suppression for some very minor and venal taxi chick fraud. And this, so, you know, this was just gossip, people heard, passed it on. So let's not think it's the internet that breaches suppression orders. It's people, because we like to gossip, we like to know. The internet's just made a bit more quicker. Not necessarily that much easier. I think it's more the speed of things where people have really wanted to know. It has come out. So finally, you know, I think the Law Commission stuff is pretty good. It is in the right direction, but my big worry, but I think we've heard on that, is if the ISP obligation is interpreted too widely, because it's not really an ISP obligation. They're actually talking about an obligation on hosts like myself. Removing material on your own site's fine. Trying to set up a filtering system where all the ISPs are blocking access to other ISPs' material would be a bit of a nightmare. But I think we've been quite reassured on that.
Okay. Thank you, David. Thank you, panel.